Hello and welcome to a new episode of Impressions of America. I'm Simon, and with me as always is Toby. Hello, Toby.
Hey, Simon.
In this episode, we will be looking at William F. Buckley Jr., perhaps the most famous and important conservative author and commentator of the last century. William Frank Buckley Jr., born in 1925, was the sixth of 10 children born to William Frank Buckley Sr., a Texas-born lawyer and oil developer. Moving between America, Mexico, France, and England as a child, William Buckley Jr. would go on to attend Yale, where he studied political science, history, and economics, and excelled on the debate team. After graduating in 1950, Buckley worked at the CIA for 2 years, where he worked for and became lifelong friends with E. Howard Hunt, who was later jailed for his part in the Watergate scandal. Buckley would go on to publish more than 60 books throughout his lifetime, but he is most famous for founding and editing the conservative magazine National Review, and for his television show Firing Line, as well as for his televised debates with Gore Vidal in the run-up to the 1968 presidential election. Buckley soon became the voice of American conservatism, especially once Ronald Reagan, a close friend and ally, was elected president in 1980. Reagan's praise and admiration of Buckley in the National Review cemented Buckley's place as the leading figure of modern conservatism. Buckley was known for his eloquent and pointed debating style, winning fans and infuriating enemies in equal measure. Buckley died in 2008, but remains a key figure to many on the right. As Lee Edwards, a historian for the Heritage Foundation, puts it, Buckley was the St. Paul of the conservative movement. We thought we'd start by kind of looking at, I suppose, what kind of made him famous to begin with and what established him as a leading figure on the right, and that's the National Review. Toby, when you think of Bill Buckley and you think of the National Review, what kind of comes to mind for you? What impact do you think he had on the right with National Review?
Well, I mean, when I think of Bill Buckley and I think of National Review, first I think of the moderation of the Eisenhower 50s period. I think of the New Deal, and I think of the fact that the New Deal had been accepted by a lot of Republicans. Maybe because of a sort of, on the pragmatic level, because a lot of Republicans looked to the war period and seemed to think of it as a ceasefire in the ideological fight, and Eisenhower was quite happy to continue the counter-cyclical demand-side policies of the FDR and Truman administration. But then Bill Buckley sort of almost seemed to come out of nowhere with the Molotov cocktail that ruined this whole, spirit of moderation that seemed to take over after the war.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's hard for us as sort of young men in a 21st century, which is so divided and which is so, there are so many different strands of attack as far as when you look at the right wing and Republicans these days, whether it be kind of the religious far right or whether it be the kind of the strong economic style of, heaven forbid the government should pay for anything, or whether it be, the far right of the NRA or anything like that. I suppose the idea of there being a sort of starting point for at least some of that is almost an oddity, I guess. But Bill Buckley, to some degree, was that. He was, as some people, I think, including his brother tried to put it, a revolutionary. He wanted.
Yeah, I think in 1957 he went on television and he basically said that verbatim. I am a revolutionary, I am a radical against the present liberal order. I mean, this is what he said,
Absolutely. And I was just looking at I wasn't aware of this until I started researching the show, but there's a mission statement from 1955 from Bill Buckley for the National Review.
Oh, okay.
And they set out a few points about some of the reasons why the National Review is around. And it lists things such as taking on a a government which is basically doing anything other than doing the bare minimum. So it talks about the growth of the government must be fought relentlessly. In this great social conflict of the era, we are, without reservations, on the libertarian side. I mean, that kind of perfectly sums up National Review to some degree, and I suppose when we think of the National Review, certainly when I think of the National Review, it's tied in with Ronald Reagan and how he sort of, with his success in the 1980s, he legitimized it in a more mainstream way when he was able to talk about how it was, you know, a godsend to him and how it was a guiding light for him.
I think before we get into Reagan, I think we do really have to set a sort of context for Republicans. Like,
absolutely.
Like I've gone and slightly touched on before with Eisenhower, but you also have to think about, because Buckley was a critic of Eisenhower's economic policy and his foreign policy. He was a critic of Nixon's economic policy and his foreign policy. You know,
absolutely.
The idea of containing communism was sort of an idea that I think Kennan had put forward and Eisenhower was going along with. I mean, there was the sort of potential revolution in Hungary that had been snuffed out. Bill Buckley and people and Bozell and people at the National Trust were disgusted that the administration would sort of leave the Hungarians, you know, to be sort of trampled on by the Soviet war machine.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, point three here from the National Review Manifesto states that the century's most blatant force of satanic utopianism is communism. You know, we consider coexistence with communism neither desirable nor possible, nor honorable. It's
exactly, yeah.
I mean, Bill Buckley, I think it was his second book, wrote about McCarthyism and what a hero, national hero McCarthy was by taking
on McCarthy and his enemies.
Yes.
And his enemies, yeah. He wrote that with his brother-in-law Bozell, who also actually shadow wrote The Conscience of a Conservative by Goldwater. So you can see immediately how crucial these people were to not only Goldwater but Reagan as well. I mean, this was the insurgency at that time.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we obviously got the kind of the far right as far as, well, parts of it as it was established, and the kind of mainstream aspect as far as McCarthyism and that kind of stuff as far as anti-communism is concerned. But there was a greater tone to how Bill Buckley was able to kind of move the conservative movement right. And as you say, Goldwater is a key component of that. And Bill Buckley, of course, was a huge fan, big friend of Goldwater.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Goldwater is that I think within the National Review family, they were very much enamored with Goldwater. There was a sort of, I think, some feelings that maybe tactically Goldwater's campaign might have been a bad idea. Certainly after 64, and before the Buckley ran in 65 to push some more of those ideas in his campaign against John Lindsay in New York, he did feel that maybe they would have to do some damage control. So I think we do see in Goldwater's campaign, sort of in the infancy of the conservative movement, and certainly the fact that those ideas, the ideas that Reagan would push, you know, lowering the marginal tax rate to 25%, deregulation, and the weakening of unions, things like increasing the United States arms in comparison to the Soviet Union. These things were considered, I think, fairly like crazy ideas. And I mean, the loss, the tremendous defeat of Goldwater shows you that how difficult a task it ends up being for Bill Buckley and National Trust to really overturn the the order at the time. But I think the way we've been talking about it so far does it sound like we are sort of deifying Bill Buckley's achievements. We're not. We're just saying that, you know, that there had been some sort of consensus in the 50s, and the Goldwater failure does show you the strength of that consensus at the time. It wasn't a period of major legislation, but it was a period where a lot of newspapers were dominated by the Arthur Schlesingers and John Kenneth Galbraiths of the time. And
yeah, absolutely. I think it's an important point you make there. Regardless of whether or not you agree with Bill Buckley, or if you're, you know, a normal, rational human being and you don't agree with Bill Buckley,
I think it's important
to establish how important a figure he was and what he did, mm-hmm. not just for the American right, but for American political discourse in general, and how America would look very different today if it weren't for Bill Buckley, if it weren't for the National Review, and if it weren't for the people who were driving that train forward. You know, American politics would be very different, and it's perhaps unfair to say we wouldn't have Reagan, but maybe we wouldn't have had Reagan, or maybe we wouldn't have had Reagan to the same degree or with the same success. So it's...
I also think, like, we have to think about how methodical this was.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think about, like, there was real, I mean, by Buckley and others on the right, real disgust for the liberal Republicans. But so like National Review is obviously a political outfit that would support a Republican, but they thought to themselves, are we going to support Eisenhower in 56? And they wrote columns, and they didn't they decided that they would just write a list of opinions, and then the corporate National Review didn't actually come out with a general opinion in 60 as well against John F. Kennedy. They felt that it might be better to not endorse Nixon. And then they pushed the campaign of Goldwater in 64. And then in 68, they, after being courted by Nixon, they managed to support him. And then in 72, they pushed a dump Nixon movement. You know, this is a movement certainly with the long-term plan, and one that didn't necessarily go for political expediency when it revealed itself, potentially, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's a very, very good point that you...
Oh, yeah, and then you have to go to 76, where they forced Reagan to run against an incumbent president and almost beat him. It's savage, really.
As you say, it was a very methodical approach National Review took, and I suppose it's interesting to see, I suppose, the results of it to some degree with Reagan and the stuff that came before it. But I think it's also interesting to note kind of how it came about and how sort of Bill Buckley himself came about, and how, you know, he was, if ever a man was sort of bred for a situation, it kind of was Bill. To a certain extent,
yeah,
he was.
Yeah, Bill was. I think it. Bill probably, he possessed part of the old conservative, and then his own sort of new conservative brand that he put together at the National Trust, because he did sort of have a sort of transcendental Catholic religion that he had been brought up with. He said himself that he was brought up in a Catholic home. With not even a small hint of tentativeness among us, you know, like everyone read from the same very long hymn sheet, essentially, you know. And I think it was a very different upbringing from, say, FDR, who you would assume comes from the same patrician class. Their Catholic upbringing was very different from the Protestant upbringing that pushed the sort of social gospel that was big in, you know, in Connecticut and New York and all those older families. I think Bill Buckley's brother said in the great documentary Best of Enemies, we were savages. We weren't part of the the Long Island Society, and I think they brought, you know, a set of principles that were of the old guard, the old Republican guard, certainly, and I think that's, that affected his perception of the New Deal in a way that that other people from his perceived class just, you know, they just didn't react to it in that way, you know.
Absolutely. And I do think, I mean, certainly for myself, I don't know about you, Toby, but whenever I hear the word libertarian, I can't help but laugh. I don't know if that's a completely fair reflection on libertarianism, but that's my first reaction. I have the reaction of the way I picture libertarianism is the, well, what, you can't tell me which side of the road to drive down on. I can drive whichever side I want, you know.
Yeah, it is funny. There is a Ron Paul, Bill Buckley interview in like 19, around like after Reagan just sort of humiliates Mondale. This is sort of, and Ron Paul is almost like, Reagan, you know, he's increased all this military spending, and he's criticizing Reagan from the right, and Bill Buckley's almost incredulous.
Yes.
because I mean, libertarianism, you know, I mean, there certainly were people like the Murray Rothbards, the Ayn Rands, the Ron Paul, who, you know, who didn't, I mean, Buckley is a radical, but they didn't have a sort of, they just weren't logistically part of the conservative movement, so didn't, I suppose they didn't have the same need to deal with the realities of politics that Buckley had to an extent.
I think that's fair. Upon doing research on Bill, I found out that his father was actually friends with a libertarian author called Albert J. Nock.
Albert J. Nock. Yeah.
And Bill Buckley Jr. was kind of encouraged to read Nock's work, and you can definitely see, I mean, who knows, perhaps regardless of whether or not his father had pushed him into that area, maybe he would have, you know, had that strong libertarian spirit regardless, but when you start to kind of get little snapshots of how he kind of grew up and the background he was in, it fits together very nicely with the man he went on to become, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he got his Christianity from his family, but I think Albert J. Nock wasn't Christian. What he got from Nock was obviously that libertarian, those libertarian sort of axioms, those values, like irrespective of the, you know, the evidence. But he also got this sort of aristocratic sense that material things weren't important. You know, that this is why I think he sort of scorned the liberal materialist way of seeing things. And I think Albert J. Nock's work did sort of radicalize Buckley in a way.
Yeah.
But obviously not to the extent that I think, you know, people like Ayn Rand and, you know, the Birches were.
Or Toby Alloway, I believe he's the most.
Oh, yeah, or myself. yeah, I mean, personally, I don't want to go, but I think the work of Kierkegaard also gives me that sort of a non-materialist, you know,
non-materialist way of capitalist,
dealing with things.
So before we kind of move on, I think we can almost, I don't know if we can kind of close the loop on National Review, but I think it's very telling that when Reagan talked about National Review, he said, this was him writing in 1962, I'd be lost without National Review. And I think that is quite a strong image of...
Yeah, Reagan sort of had his own personal pilgrimage from away from being a sort of Democrat, a Democrat who was very anti-communist, to reading Whittaker Chambers' book, I think Witness it's called, and then reading National Review sort of every morning. And then I think he said about Bill Buckley while he was president that, you know, it was a... He remembers the time primeval, a world of nightmares, and then Bill Buckley came with his plan and his clipboard, and things haven't been the same again. He draws almost sort of these almost like medieval pictures of Buckley, sort of casting away the Dark Age, and all it was I guess the top marginal tax was 90%, and maybe you had to work and then maybe workers had bargaining rights jointly. With America, it wasn't some sort of dystopia, but
it is funny the dreams that certain American politicians on the right have. I remember Paul Ryan talking about when they were putting through one of those reform bills the other I think it was last year, and he talked about how he'd envisioned this since he was a young man at college, about that's the kind of dreams they have about making rich people richer.
I think Paul Ryan definitely was he might have been a young devotee of I'm not saying he was sort of he just grew up on Bill Buckley's knee. I'm just saying he read a lot of National Trust, but I think Ryan is a excellent segue into Buckley and some other right-wing figures that maybe didn't have the same impact on the conservative movement, but necessarily still to today, you can see their power in the conservative movement.
Absolutely, and Paul Ryan is he is nothing but a lover of Ayn Rand, I believe. I think we'll get onto that.
Apparently he gives his all of his young staffers Atlas Shrugged to read.
I mean, why wouldn't you? As a good Christian should, I believe. The moral decision right there.
It's really interesting because I think the first time Buckley met Rand, that they were both obviously strict anti-communists. They both despised Eisenhower, but she must have said something like, "You are much too smart to believe in God," and he kept on sending her liturgical sermons for the next, until she died afterwards. So,
For Buckley,
clearly there was lines of conflict had been sort of erected.
Absolutely. I mean, for Buckley, religion wasn't just a sort of tool to win over, Hicks from the South. He had a belief that Christianity was the core of what made America and what made the Republican Party.
Exactly, and other figures in the National Trust had that belief too. I think Buckley himself, especially in On Liberalism, when talking about democracy and even votes for African Americans, he sort of marginalizes democracy. Buckley, and this is strange, but Buckley felt that democracy hadn't been, he thought it was strange that the wars had been fought for democracy. He felt that the freedoms that Americans had inherited flowed from free enterprise and Christianity. And, Ayn Rand's beliefs were anathema to him.
Well, absolutely. I think we'll probably get a little bit more into Rand a little bit later on, but one of the things that kind of started the conversations between Toby and I with regards to the great, in quotation marks, if you like, Bill Buckley, is...
Buckley loves to use irony, and he puts almost anyone who is supposed to be he will write these economists in apostrophe just to ironically deride them. They're not economists, and verbatim, they're not economists, they're just political theorists.
Well, the thing that kind of drew Toby and I together on this was a film called Best of Enemies,
Best of Enemies, yeah.
Which is available on Netflix, certainly in the UK, and I believe it's fairly readily available. And it's a documentary about Bill Buckley and Gore Vidal. And in 1968, they had a series of debates on television where Bill Buckley and Gore Vidal went hand-to-hand, toe-to-toe, face-to-face against each other to discuss not just the specific politics of that day and, you know, the leading candidates, but more about a philosophy of America, I suppose, Toby.
Yeah, just before that, I would like to sort of say that Bill Buckley's rhetorical style, it's very different from, but I don't know, have you ever listened to, say, 538 or the Vox podcasts, you know, or NPR? There's a sort of voice that they have, and it's sort of mellow and it's monotonous, and it's the go-to voice of debate, or a go-to voice of, you know, enlightenment. Buckley's register was completely different. I think in on liberalism, he just spoke with disgust about the moderation that that the liberals had shown, and instead of that, what he tried to do is he tried to make his debates sort of, you know, amphitheaters of high melodrama. Obviously, Buckley was very empirical, and he was very direct, he was very evidence-based, but he would also use them as ways to deride people in power through the use of irony and sarcasm. And he unloaded that on Gore Vidal, who unfortunately seems to come from the same... I mean, being a sort of literary giant himself, he seems to come from the same cloth almost.
It is interesting. It was kind of two sides of the same coin kind of thing. They were...
Yeah.
They in theory, were kind of off the same sort of background, off the same blood. And I suppose to a kind of... an untrained American ear, they almost kind of sound the same, in the such as they don't sound like the average American.
Oh, no. There's a guy in the documentary who says that if two guys sounded like this today, they would almost sound to be heartless, you know, in a country of, you know, almost widespread middle-class self-identity. You mean that is not, those accents aren't democratized language.
No.
It's there to distinguish people.
it almost reminds me a little bit of how on today on like the BBC you have a lot of, you know, more regional accents, and you have
the BBC have certainly tried.
Whereas the BBC in the past, you had these sort of fantastically linguistic type people who would come on with some sort of accents that you almost couldn't imagine being around anymore. And that's almost the sort of similar thing to Vidal and Buckley, where...
Yeah, I think, like, if you watch Cheers, you know, Frasier.
Yes.
Think Frasier.
Well, I mean, I can now only imagine Frasier and Gore Vidal and Bill Buckley together, and that's all I can think of, so... So, just to set the scene a little bit, leading up to the 1968 election, you had sort of three main... TV stations in America, networks in America. You had CBS with the great Walter Cronkite, you had NBC with Hunter and Brinkley, and then in third place you had ABC. And ABC didn't have the budget or the means to compete with those two, so they had to be a bit more creative. They didn't have the time or the budget to spend on the political side of things, as far as covering conventions the way that the other two networks did, so they got a bit creative and they got a debate going. And the debate was obviously Bill Buckley on the right and Gore Vidal on the left. The film Best of Enemies is fascinating viewing. You know, it's really, really interesting viewing to watch, regardless of what side of the political spectrum you fall down on. I think as a introduction to Bill Buckley and Gore Vidal, I think it's a really great place to start. And I know we both thoroughly enjoyed the film.
Wow, yeah, tremendously, because I think in 2018 there is a lot of work being done on the sort of spirit of 68, the sort of, I think, shattering of a of the old political consensus that had come after the wars. And I think this movie, certainly for the American political consensus, is a clear indicator of, you know, how I think ferocious these sort of cultural these cultural battles were becoming in American life. And I think that the convention in 1968, just by itself, you know, is something that is interesting. And then being projected by these two men, both, you know, both from the same class, but also both having such diametrically opposed points of view, it's a fantastic documentary.
Absolutely. I do wonder whether or not, without that 1968 debate, whether or not we would have Bill Buckley to the same degree. It's probably we still would have, simply because we'd still had National Review going all that time, and his own television show Firing Line was happening around that time as well. So it's not like this was the making of Bill Buckley, but certainly from the documentary, it gave the impression that this was another foot in the door for Bill Buckley with kind of the standard American viewer.
And stylistically, you can see, I think he does, you know, shows with Woody Allen. I mean, obviously, Buckley in some ways is a very antiquated figure, but, you know, he's appreciated by liberals because he can build from their premises, but he's also appreciated by liberals because he's good on television, you know?
Well, I mean, there's a clip on in Best of Enemies where Mr. Woody and Bill Buckley are discussing, well, they're having a conversation, and a young woman from the crowd asks a question. I think it's to do with miniskirts, and Bill Buckley responds, I think it's something to do with, are miniskirts too short or are they inappropriate? And Bill Buckley kind of gives a sly look and he says, not on you, my dear.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really hard to watch that in 2018, you know, because if you did anything like that these days, you know, unless you're running for president, your career would be over. But
unless you're running for president.
But it's...
That's the only office that... Well, one can be so immodest.
Yeah, with the highest office in the land became sort of the highest point of skirt in the land. It was,
you know, it's high irony. I think Buckley would have enjoyed it.
but being able to look at Woody Allen and Bill Buckley kind of converse like that, it does give you an indication that Bill Buckley wasn't this strange figure on the right who had no dealings with anybody else. You know, he did become a mainstream figure. You know, he wasn't some sort of figure, you know, stuck on some sort of pre-Fox News channel. You know, he was right in the middle of the culture that was going around.
Exactly. I mean, he was a heated polemicist, definitely in the pages of National Trust. But on television, he should just use, you know, his wit. I mean, someone once asked Buckley, why is it you lean down, or you lean back during your interviews, and he says, because I can't handle the weight of what I know, you know, and it sparkles, yeah.
It's... Absolutely. It's, Bill Buckley could turn a phrase certainly better than I ever could, and better than...
I think it's always important for political movements. I mean, you know, whatever candidates' views are, they have to have something about them that people can invest themselves in.
There's always a human level to politics.
Yeah, exactly. You have to become enamored with someone for some other reason beyond the politics, and certainly Bill Buckley had that cachet.
Absolutely. You know, you compare him in the complete opposite direction to someone like Ed Miliband in the UK, where, you know, it's regardless of what he might believe and what he might do, it's in the package of Ed Miliband, so it's never going to be able to be sold to the public.
Yeah, I do want to sort of go into another interview that Buckley did with Kenneth Galbraith, because I think it further underlines the points of Bill Buckley's style. I think during the early Reagan administration, Reagan had looked to sort of bring the top tax rate down from 70% to 25%. And Buckley brought on Kenneth Galbraith, who had written The Affluent Society. This was the sort of, you know, enfant terrible of liberal economics at the time. But these two were friends. So, you know, Buckley opens up with a salvo and says, you know, Kenneth went, he went to Berkeley where he honed his superstitions. He went to Harvard where he corrupted the youth. You know, he always uses ironies just to bring people down to size. And even when they're discussing the tax rate, Galbraith is sort of equal to Buckley. He says, you know, when they're discussing the Reagan thrust, Galbraith says, "I want to consider the Buckley and Reagan thrust that has gone back since the 18th century." He almost seems to present Buckley and Reagan thrust as a sort of like antiquated, like dark age economics, framed against his own sort of more enlightened Keynesianism. And then Buckley sort of responds, are you done with the New Deal? I don't want to rub it in. You know, I think especially when Buckley is talking to a friend as opposed to talking to someone, you know, like Vidal, who, you know, is sort of antimatter, there's a sense in which this sort of almost like tongue-in-cheek irony comes to the fore, even when they're discussing something as, you know, as woolly-headed as you know, the Phillips curve and the difference between the marginal tax rate. You know, this is exactly the kind of way Buckley presents. But Galbraith also makes another point. You know, Buckley is talking about you know, Reaganomics, and they're discussing Reaganomics, but Buckley switches to extremes. Like his form of sort of polemical style seemed to not only reach out for evidence-based debate, but, you know, when someone would say something as like what we should increase the tax rate, he would almost frame it as the person was, you know, we're moving to pseudo-communism. You know, at any time, you know, Buckley wasn't just sort of like the wonks on, you know, Vox. He wasn't simply just debating you on the merits. He would always use, you know, almost highs and lows. It's sort of a Baroque style debate that I think can grate on people, and I think can present itself almost as fictitious, even though it's evidence based.
Absolutely. And you know, with Bill Buckley in Best of Enemies, he was asked about, you know, who would he absolutely not debate, and he said, I won't debate a communist, and I won't debate Gore Vidal.
I wouldn't debate a communist. That's also a very important point. I think Buckley's anti-communism, I mean, he would debate liberals, and he would present them as types, even though he would debate them on the merits. I think he had a sort of almost like he did feel that communism was analogous to fascism, and this is why he supported McCarthy, despite the fact that McCarthy's whole style was almost antithetical to Bill's empirical but colorful style.
It is an interesting match you have there. You know, it's the styles and almost the beliefs to some extent of McCarthy and Buckley are so different, yet their core of fighting communism unites them in a way which is almost some sort of, you know, it's a couple who maybe don't agree or disagree on everything, but there's maybe one or two things which unites them and keeps them together. And with Buckley and McCarthy, you got that with strong anti-communism, which, again, you know, to our 21st century ears, that's kind of comical. You know, I mean, you bring up, you know, being anti-communist, and you sort of, you think of, you know, 80s propaganda films or something, you know, like
Red Dawn. Sort of like, almost like delirious red scares.
Yes, the red
and
under the
bed. Thing about McCarthy is that he produced, you know, it was in the wake of the Alger Hiss thing. You know, Nixon had been sort of almost like his meteoric rise to vice president and just senator first and then vice president had been sponsored by the fact that he had brought Alger Hiss out. Alger Hiss was a sort of, you know, almost like Dauphin of the liberal sort of the liberal cultural Eastern establishment, and by proving that Alger Hiss had been a spy, Nixon was sort of built up as this new Republican hero. But so, and McCarthy wanted to do the same thing that Nixon did. In one press conference, he brought out a list of 25 names. He didn't reveal the names. 25 names of potential communists in the government that apparently people knew. Dean Acheson knew that these people were communists. Never revealed their names. And then he just left, and then he started changing the accusations. And his people at the time and historians have said that all his stuff was completely fictitious. But Buckley seemed to back him because of almost a spiritual consistency between them.
It's almost unbelievable, you know, in this day and age that wild accusations would be made against people in government. I can't think of any movement in the last few years that has happened there. I mean, talk about a time in the past.
Yeah, and I think that sort of, you know, that the idea of, a conservative pushing non-facts for, you know, sheer emotion is not, you know, is it? Maybe it's not new. I don't know.
Yeah, and again, you know, that's another point. This would be probably the only time that the right wing have ever gone to, you know, having to create their own kind of facts to back up their kind of beliefs. So that in itself is an interesting bubble. So, you know.
Yeah, it's such an interesting vacuum in history. I mean,
they should really try that again sometime. I think it might work.
Yeah.
So before we kind of leave Vidal, I mean, it's probably worth noting that in one of the later debates, Vidal really gets under Buckley's skin and calls him a crypto-Nazi, and that really sets off Bill, and he calls...
Don't call me a crypto-Nazi.
Yeah, and he refers to him as a queer, and that he wants to punch him in the face, and all this sort of stuff, and you can see that Buckley completely loses his cool. And in that moment, certainly the film presents it as Vidal won, quote unquote, you know, he won that debate. He won the kind of the meeting of two great intelligence by reducing Buckley to, you know, homophobic slurs and empty threats. You know, it's whether or not that is the case, I'm sure people who thought Buckley was right on the issues would have continued to think Buckley was right on the issues regardless. I also think it's interesting we're at a specific age where people on the right very much would support someone if they said something along those lines and would say, I mean, one of the defenses that Trump comes up with and his people come up with is that Trump is saying it as it is and he's not hiding behind, you know, being politically correct anymore and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, everyone gives him a cheer. I suppose for Bill that it's different because he did have a moral center of sorts and he wasn't happy about the way things had happened, and, you know, it probably felt as much a defeat to him personally as it did to anyone else on the outside by the looks of it.
Yeah, I think Bill, in the documentary, it mentioned that Bill felt that he had won a lot of personal victories, but politically, I mean, up to that point, in the grand scheme of things, he'd failed. But I think that was a, you know, personal defeat to Bill, and it was a sort of, it was, you know, he was hysterical in that moment. You know, his style is cut and thrust in sort of, you know, high volleys of melodrama, but that was completely devoid of his usual empiricism. So, you know, it was a very bad moment for him.
Absolutely. We're going to go on to a section with just some questions about Bill Buckley, but first there are kind of a couple of names I'm just going to throw at you, Toby, and I'm sure your face will light up with glee. It's a shame we don't have a camera on you at the moment, but Birches and Rand, does that sort of does that spring anything into mind for you?
You know, I think if we were to go a little bit more, you know, cultish, we could do a whole podcast on, you know, both of these groups.
Absolutely. And I think that as you say, it's probably a separate podcast within itself to be able to delve into
two separate
groups.
Podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on Rand's side, you know, you have this, I don't know how you would describe Ayn Rand apart from, I mean, she was such a full-bodied, full-figured person and belief system all within itself. I mean, she had people of great high power coming to her for wisdom and kind of coming to her altar. You know, she wasn't a minor figure. You know, she was the big deal. You know, and
I mean, in 54, after the Fountainhead had sold millions and millions of copies, I mean, she dwarfed Bill Buckley in the Conservative.
Absolutely, yeah.
Point.
It is interesting that Bill Buckley and Ayn Rand did have this, you know, coming together, this disagreement. You know, obviously Bill Buckley very religious and Ayn Rand very not religious. You did have that core belief in both hating communist, but they were so opposed on that religious basis that it does make you wonder, maybe if, when we were talking earlier, we talked about, you know, McCarthy and Buckley maybe not being similar in every way, but they were united by their hate of communism. Mm-hmm. Rand and Buckley did have that shared hate of communism, and yet they were so diametrically opposed on so many other things that kind of removed any relationship they could have had.
Yeah, like you said, it all flowed from Buckley's sort of Christianity. I think the Evans Review and the National Trust of, I mean, he quite liked Fountainhead, but when they read Atlas Shrugged, it was just, you know, just, they were all stunned by it. I think Whittaker Chambers said that he had never read anything so devoid of goodness. You know, he proposed that he was looking for the sentence where someone would be told, go to the gas chamber, go. It was, I mean, the National Trust really, really put down this book. And obviously the book sold, you know, millions and millions of copies, but Rand, you know, conservatives around the National Trust and conservatives in administrations, you know, they no longer talked about coming to the conservative movement through Atlas Shrugged. The Whittaker Chambers and the Evans Review, which goes on about, you know, Christianity as the sort of fountainhead of, you know, ironically, of free market ideas and all the freedoms that Americans had come to know. So, I mean,
certainly.
But then you also think that Buckley realized himself, you know, in the 70s and 80s that, although logistically she had been shut out, Rand had gone into the blood of conservatism in a way that he looked at with some horror.
Absolutely. And it is interesting, certainly from our kind of outside scope of it, that, you know, you can almost see the, are you an Atlas Shrugged Republican or you're a National Review Republican?
Yeah, at CPAC we should run that vote next time we're there.
Okay, so that's Rand dealt with. If anyone's not familiar,
I'm a Goldwater girl, by the way. So, yeah.
that seems fair. So that's Rand. Birches was not a name I was hugely familiar with. I think I'd maybe heard it in passing, just through things I'd
read.
Yeah,
the John Birch Society are famous for the idea that Eisenhower was a communist, which, I mean, it's so jarring. I mean. They believe that 50 to 80% of the American government was dominated by communists. And John Welch put together his manuscript, you know, his book of crazy. And he sent it out to his collective, the people, you know, the true believers. And because Welch had actually been an early investor in National Trust, he sent it out to Bill Buckley. Bill Buckley, who was also an arch anti-communist and who thought the New Deal was, the nightmarish prime evil. and Buckley read this book, you know, with and it was fantastical. He thought it was madness, but he framed it in a way that would be polite to Welch and just said that he disagreed with him on some of the essentials. And obviously Welch immediately told him to send him back the manuscripts.
I believe Buckley sort of steered away from that group and denounced them.
Yeah, I mean, in the early 60s, certainly, there were many people who were Birchers. Some people in the National Trust were Birchers. Goldwater's famous comment about, being an extremist for liberty is no vice. It sort of was drawn out of the well of sort of Bircher fanaticism, I think. Norman Mailer was at the 1964 convention, and he heard that, and he just thought, "Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I'm a writer, but I don't need. Thank you for all the help, you know." But the thing about the Birchers, though, I think, towards the end of the 60s, National Trust, because National Trust was so rooted in, you know, empiricism in terms of the facts they brought to bear on their own interpretation, they eventually started to attack the Birchers and members of the Birchers and to exorcise the conservative movement of this sort of conspiracy theory club.
Which, I mean, it's really only kind of keeping going together these days because you and I are running it, but...
But, you know, I mean, the thing about John Welch and Ayn Rand, you know, I mean, that Buckley thrust of conservatism is not the only form of conservatism that is around. If we're looking clear-eyed at the 2018 scene, I mean, there are many John Birches and Ayn Rands around.
Absolutely. Before we end the podcast, we thought we'd just spend a couple minutes on two or three questions just to kind of round it out. The first question is probably maybe a question you might have at home if you're listening to this, is why are we doing a podcast on Buckley? What makes him interesting to us? And for me, part of the reason is because it's an interesting mix of, you know, political and media and that side of stuff. Because, you know, we are very much interested in how kind of politics and media ties together. I think part of it also comes from the fact that we like talking about Republicans and GOP and this kind of stuff and these big figures. And certainly speaking for myself, maybe because being someone who is more liberal, it's easier to dissect in a more neutral way, perhaps, being able to find the faults with, you know, a Republican or someone I don't agree with, maybe on a lot of issues. Maybe it's somewhat telling that our first two podcasts are about figures on the right, and perhaps it's telling about how we want to dissect that as it is about the figures themselves. I don't know about you, Toby, why you think you and I are drawn to figures like Bill Buckley.
I think Buckley is interesting because I think, you know, if you go back to the Vox and the 538 way of presenting it, and the Obama way of politics, there's a lot of compromise. There's a lot of wonkatry. Economics professors and people of that nation. And Buckley, the thing about Buckley had an intellectual group behind him. You know, people of the Mont Pelerin Society, economists like Friedman and Hayek, who were putting forward, you know, ideas and winning, I mean, let's be honest, winning Nobel Prizes. So Buckley was dipping into wonkatry himself, but he was also presenting it in a way that I think energized the political base in the way I don't think they have. Just looking at it from, a neutral non-political perspective. It seems like Buckley was able to, I think the son of Irvin Kristol said that, you know, reading National Trust when he was young was, you know, all of these sort of all of these complicated words, learning all of these complicated words, learning all of these arguments, learning Buckley's style, it was becoming a conservative. And I think someone who has that power to both join, you know, empiricism to, I think, sort of colorful energy, it's quite interesting, both and as sort of a counterpoint to some of the politics we've seen, and to sort of counterpoint to some of the other politics we've seen,
Absolutely.
From you know, and those who would not be named. I mean,
I suppose to also see some sort of, you know, grandfather type figure off.
Yeah, that's certainly with people like Ann Coulter. I think she wrote an article about being the informed to read, or the young Buckley. You know, she perceived. I mean, she writes it in a much more Philistine style than Buckley does. But it's, yeah, you know, there is a lot of conservatives, even pre-Trump, who took on Buckley's sort of colorful, ironic style. I don't think to the same success. They haven't been as funny, and I don't think they cling to the same need to be as evidence-based, obviously, and it just seems to get worse and worse.
Absolutely. I think the fact that his style as much as his content, I think, is probably what draws us in. I think,
yeah, his style definitely has been absolutely. You know, Galbraith once asked Buckley, you know sometimes I admit error. Do you ever admit errors? And Buckley says yes, which is why I'm so silent, you know?
That must be why you and I talk so much, Toby.
Well, yeah, I mean. I'm just a rich reservoir of.
So, one obvious question, when, you know, it's sort of been brought up already, but it's very difficult to look through any part of Republican history now and not frame it through, at least partly through the lens of Trump. Buckley himself had issues with Trump, you know.
Yeah, as he says, what was it that he said about Trump?
He said, this is from 2000, this is what Bill Buckley wrote. "Look for the narcissist. The most obvious target in today's lineup is, of course, Donald Trump. When he looks at a glass, he is mesmerized by its reflection. If Donald Trump were shaped a little differently, he would compete for Miss America." Which is, you know, I mean, I would say that's kind of harsh on Miss America, to be perfectly honest, but it certainly kind of, you know, it sums up the negativity. And
Trump is in the business of smart. I think he just associates all of that, but Buckley just associates all of that together. It's just,
absolutely. I think Bill, because obviously, you know, 2000, you know, Trump wasn't president or anything back then, I think it was much easier for him to be able to pick apart someone like Trump and see him.
Yeah,
as...
I think Trump was trying to run on the reform party line in the early 2000s. He was looking potentially to run, and Buckley had to, you know, cut and thrust.
Absolutely.
If only we had you know, him and his gamelan sword. And, you know, people at National Trust did write their own, you know, opinions on Trump, and they repudiated him across the boards. But I think there's an important thing, I think, when we try to compare Buckley to Trump. I think, obviously, we've said that Buckley's style was, you know, it was obviously high melodrama in many ways that Trump is, but Buckley was based on empiricism. I actually want to bring on you know, Michel Foucault. I think I might singe some middle brows bringing on weird French intellectual, but Foucault talked about sort of different institutions of truth. You know, we think about truth as just the, you know, facts, but there are different sciences and institutions of truth. Economics is an institution of truth, and the thing about it is that Buckley was attacking, you know, sort of institutions that were respected by people, like, you know, the all of these newspapers he considered to be liberal, and the television stations. And he in God and Man and Yale, he attacked whole departments. But Buckley also pulled into other intellectual currents. You know, he was very much friends with Friedman and Hayek and all those other people. So he had his own institutions of truth. And the thing about Trump is that he seems to have refuted all of the institutions that are supposed to guard ideas of truth and facts in so almost like modern society. It's all emotion.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting when you can to some extent draw a line from, you know, Trump to Reagan to Bill Buckley, you know, etc.
Yeah.
We did talk about how Buckley did move things further to the right, and, you know, you have Goldwater and that side of stuff. So, you know, there is definitely a comparison there to be made. But there's also a great divide between Bill Buckley and Donald Trump as far as specific people are concerned, even if the movements that kind of birthed Donald Trump as president now could be sort of seen as partly created, at least, by Buckley and National Review?
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, certainly Buckley, you know, he pushed a lot of the stuff that McCarthy was doing, which he knew was anti-thought, but he had a spiritual likeness to McCarthy. Although in McCarthy and his enemies, Buckley did have a sort of judicious, you know, sort of studied look at McCarthy's accusations, and did say that some of them were bullshit in the book. But yeah, there is certainly that tinge to Buckley. But I think the overarching Bill Buckley on sort of the issues of facts and interpretation is clearly very different from Trump.
For me, I think the most interesting aspect of Trump and Bill Buckley is, although, you know, the USSR, Russia of Buckley's age, of, you know, the 70s and 80s, you know, it is different to, you know, USSR and Russia as it is today, there is obviously, I'm sure Bill Buckley would have had issue with this idea of the meetings that took place with Trump and the Russians, and with the no doubt, you know, I mean, it's, there appears to be evidence there of some sort of, you know, influencing of results in election, that kind of stuff. You know, we did talk about Buckley's not exactly, you know, Mr. Democracy, but I'm sure even he...
Oh, yeah, he certainly isn't Mr. Democracy. I mean, he supported all of the coups.
Yes,
all of the fascist dictators
absolutely.
That America put in place.
Absolutely.
All of them.
And
certainly, you know, isn't Mr. Democracy at all, no.
Absolutely. But I do wonder if he would have drawn the line, whether it be, you know, hypocritical or not, if Trump and Russia was in itself a coup against United States democracy, whether it be on a purely nationalist kind of level of not on our soil kind of thing, I do wonder how Buckley would have seen Trump and Russia. And
yeah, I think it's hard on one level, but then you also have to think about the people who have been influenced by Bill Buckley and the National Trust, people like David Frum and David Brooks, you know, the people who have sort of center-right views but have been let in by the liberal media, you know, have Atlantic magazine columns and New York Times columns. Those people, because of, I think, some of their social obligations, just find Trump just disgusting and have seem to have, you know, done a not on my soil move when it comes to Russia.
Absolutely. I think one of the phrases that kind of springs to mind, you know, when we talk about Russia and we talk about Trump, and, you know, we talk about, you know, the kind of the lack of backbone the GOP is showing as far as being able to stand up, is this idea of party over country. And, you know, it's the GOP would rather kind of successfully win elections on a kind of tainted country than they would kind of lose a kind of non-tainted election, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, and I think in the center, in the political center, you had a lot of people who do respect American institutions. And I think there is a sort of, to bring up Edmund Burke, and I think Buckley would have seen that protecting American institutions was the most important. There's obviously a criticism on the left to be had that actually some American institutions need, or and even on the right, you know, need to be overturned. But I think in the center, where I think Buckley perhaps would have been on these issues, that the protection of American institutions, especially against the foreign enemy, would have been, I think he would have been salient to him.
Absolutely. Well, that's us kind of round the full hour, as it were, for the show.
It's so interesting that we have, you know, this is the Impressions of America, obviously a shallow reference to Oscar Wilde, but
indeed, yep.
It's almost like we've reached into the Wildean canon and pulled out one of the silly Tories in one of his plays. It's perfect.
Absolutely. I don't know how you kind of necessarily end a podcast on Bill Buckley. You could go the Gore Vidal route, who, after Buckley's death, simply wrote WFB, rest in hell.
WFB, rest in hell.
That is one way to end it.
It's funny because, speaking of people who seem to have very little respect for the newly deceased, Buckley did write in Ayn Rand's obituary a liturgical prayer, you know. So, just like Vidal, very much, I think, saucy till the end.
Yeah, I think what you can say about Bill Buckley was he was very much full 100% Bill Buckley. You know.
Most definitely.
If the idea of living a good life is being your true self, then I suppose he very much did live a good life. You know, he became a kingmaker with Reagan. He became this hero to the public and right. Whether or not he was a good person, whether or not the things he did were it for the greater good of the human race and for the American people, that's, I suppose, up to each individual person. I mean, I suppose all you can really see.
I suppose it might be up for a different podcast, maybe.
Absolutely. Maybe. Absolutely.
But I mean, the spectacle of Bill Buckley, I mean, that's the style, I think, created the spectacle of high drama, cut and thrust, debate, and, clever talk. Certainly the spectacle of Bill Buckley is immortal. And I think certainly he has things to teach us, both about, about empiricism in politics and about how to attract a wider audience as well.
Absolutely. And I think as sort of burgeoning broadcasters ourselves here, I think if nothing else, we should have respect for how Bill is able to create an audience for himself.
He did all of this, you know, Goldwater, Reagan, you know, eventually school vouchers, and you know, the welfare reform that came in the Clinton administration. All of these things flowed from him, but he did that with a wink and a smile, so you know.
Well, I mean, that's the very very least you can ask of a person, I suppose, with his level of intelligence. You know, I mean,
like you said, you know, he lived a full life.
Yeah, he absolutely did. Well, that will pretty much end it for where we are on Bill Buckley. Like I said, we could probably talk for another hour on Bill. Sadly, that we'll have to maybe wait for future podcasts at a future time.
Yeah,
but our next podcast will be something slightly different. I guess we're going to delve a little bit more into Toby and myself and kind of discuss.
I think I'll do some more, a little bit more reading on Nixon and you know, his style, and then we'll just bring the post and us the stuff we've done on Bill Buckley, and then try to think about how we're going to go on from here. You know, it's going to be about me and you.
Absolutely. Our next podcast will kind of be kind of a better discussion on what we think about certain things and how we've got kind of got to this point where we've created a podcast about 20th century American history, and hopefully kind of give you guys at home a chance to kind of learn a little bit more about us and learn about why, you know, Toby and I both have Bill Buckley tattoos. It's probably worth exploring.
Yeah. I might get a Bill Buckley and the Unmaking of a Mayor tattoo potentially after I read it, because it's supposed to have Tom Wolfe style. And on Tom Wolfe, you know, Bill and Tom had some R.I.P. Tom Wolfe, first of all.
Yeah.
Another very interesting conservative, but Bill and Tom had some wonderful conversations on contemporary art and contemporary architecture, and obviously they brought their beliefs to bear on that as well. And I think I'll be going around trying to sort of dictate and criticize the art world, but also using it as a social signifier as well. So yeah.
Well, I
think... in the Buckley spirit. and the Tom Wolfe spirit.
Absolutely. I think on the idea of a Buckley spirit, we should probably say goodbye before we go any further into that. I think we can only imagine what that might be. Toby, thank you very much for joining me again today, and I will be speaking to you again in the near future. Thank you, Toby.
Fabulous. See you.
Thank you.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.